Hello, this is your Polycast for Thursday, June 2nd, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. On today's edition, Governor Dayton lays out conditions for a special session and no civil rights charges in the Jamar Clark shooting. Governor Dayton has signed the spending bill that lawmakers passed on the last day of the 2016 session, but he's refusing to sign the tax bill unless corrections are made. Dayton says that a potentially expensive error in the bill has to be fixed, possibly in a special session, but he said he won't call that special session unless legislative leaders also agree to a list of demands. Tim Pugmire has more.
Dayton said an unintended drafting error related to charitable gambling taxes would cost the state more than $102 million over the next 3 years and choke the revenue stream for the new Viking Stadium. If not corrected, the revenue loss will trigger a 10% hike in the tax on stadium suite rentals. Dayton said that's why he hasn't acted on the tax bill.
I have until next Monday to sign it, so I'll wait and see what the response is of the four caucus leaders. But I'm not going to sign the bill as it is now because of this $101 million error.
Dayton is also insisting that lawmakers reinstate a tax exemption for the Minnesota State High School League that helps low-income students participate in sports. Many lawmakers have already been asking for a special session. They want another chance to pass the $1 billion bonding bill that fell short in the closing minutes of the regular session. But Dayton wants the House and Senate to redo the transportation projects in the bonding bill, and he wants them to include a funding provision for metro area transit projects, including Southwest Light Rail.
It should give the Metropolitan Council the ability through local government taxation to raise the revenues or through some other procedure to raise revenues.
Dayton wants the bonding bill to include another eight projects totaling $183 million. His list includes the University of Minnesota Health Sciences building, upgrades at the Minnesota Security Hospital, and the Fort Snelling Visitor Center. He's also demanding nearly $80 million in additional spending, including money for higher education, security hospital staffing, and economic development incentives.
We could have this special session next week. We could have it as soon as they're willing to agree to these requirements, and we could get this all done. And for the sake of those affected by the tax bill, it'll give everybody the assurance that what they thought was in there is going to be signed into law.
The tax bill would reduce taxes by about $800 million over the next 3 years. There are tax breaks for college students, middle-income families, farmers, and businesses. The bill also puts the state tax code in better alignment with federal credits and deductions. Republican House Speaker Kurt Dowd said he's ready to meet with Dayton soon to begin discussing a special session. He's agreeable to Dayton's proposed tax bill fixes. But Dowd offered a blunt assessment of how the governor's bid for more spending would go over with his caucus.
Like a lead balloon, probably, but that's part of negotiations, right? I mean, I'm not drawing any lines in the sand to say we will or will not.
Dowd went on to say he's willing to be flexible as long as Dayton is equally reasonable in his demands.
If he's going to have everything exactly the way he wants it, or he's not going to call a special session, it's probably going to be difficult to get there. And I think that's really unfortunate.
The supplemental spending bill that Dayton signed uses $182 million of the state's budget surplus. The bill includes $25 million for pre-kindergarten, $35 million for rural broadband expansion, and $35 million for programs aimed at addressing racial economic disparities. The budget bill also includes some tax provisions, including an exemption for military pension income. Covering politics, I'm Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News.
No federal criminal civil rights charges will be filed against the two Minneapolis police officers who confronted and killed 24-year-old Jamar Clark, a black man, last fall. U.S. Attorney Andy Luger announced yesterday that the FBI's independent investigation did not uncover evidence to show officers Mark Ringenberg and Daryl Schwarzy violated Clark's civil rights. But some community members still say the case should have been put in front of a jury. Brant Williams has the story.
U.S. Attorney Andy Luger says the FBI spent hundreds of hours investigating the shooting. He says FBI agents interviewed some witnesses multiple times. They examined the officers' phone records to see who they called immediately following the shooting. Andy says a federal medical examiner conducted an additional autopsy on Clark's body. And while the federal investigation included steps not taken in the state's criminal examination, the results were the same. Luger says the officers' actions did not justify prosecution.
To prove that a shooting such as occurred here violated Mr. Clark's rights, the government would have had to establish, beyond a reasonable doubt, that the officers' use of force was objectively unreasonable based on the circumstances at the time.
Officers Ringenberg and Schwarzy claimed that Clark was resisting their efforts to get him to show his hands. Ringenberg grabbed at Clark and tackled him. He claims Clark had a hold of his pistol while the two were on the ground. Schwarzy told investigators that he shot Clark in the head because he feared for the life of his partner and his own. However, some witnesses told a very different story. They told investigators Clark was not resisting the officers and was in handcuffs when he was shot. But others claimed they didn't see him in cuffs. Luger says much of the federal investigation sought to clarify whether handcuffs were used on Clark. And he says even witnesses who said they saw Clark in cuffs had different accounts. Luger says some saw Clark with his hands cuffed in front of his body, and others said they were cuffed behind him. And he says that would make it hard for prosecutors to make their case in court.
If we chose one version over the others, all of the remaining versions would come into evidence, making it very difficult for a jury to believe beyond a reasonable doubt whichever version the government put forth.
Luger says the decision not to indict the officers was also influenced by lack of physical evidence that Clark was handcuffed. And he pointed to evidence supporting Ringenberg's story, namely the presence of Clark's DNA on Ringenberg's utility belt and pistol. Nakima Levy-Pounds is a lawyer and president of the Minneapolis NAACP. She says a trial jury should be able to decide which eyewitness accounts are credible and consider if physical evidence like DNA is convincing. And Levy-Pounds says state and federal prosecutors apparently follow a different set of standards when it comes to police officers who face misconduct allegations.
How many African Americans are prosecuted
Absolutely.
On a regular basis
right.
by the federal government,
Listen.
By the Hennepin County attorney,
testimony.
By the Minneapolis city attorney, where there's conflicting testimony,
Absolutely.
Where there's scant evidence,
yeah. mm-hmm.
and they still go forward?
Levy-Pounds and other activists who gathered outside the FBI headquarters in Brooklyn Center said they were upset and frustrated. Nathaniel Kalik is the former head of the St. Paul NAACP. 15 years ago, Kalik and other civil rights leaders reached a federally mediated agreement seeking to end racial profiling by police and improve police-community relations in St. Paul. And he's been involved in efforts that have led to the creation of a civilian review board and new training for officers. Kalik says none of those efforts have worked.
You know, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired.
That's right.
Dealing with this stuff we've been dealing with for years.
Kalik and others decided to skip a private meeting between members of the community and federal authorities. FBI Special Agent in Charge Richard Thornton had announced an effort to initiate discussions with community leaders about police use of force and find ways to improve police-community relations. Bishop Richard Howell of Shiloh Temple International Ministries in North Minneapolis did attend the meeting, which included members of Clark's family and federal officials. He says now is not the time to point fingers at any one agency, including the Department of Justice.
We felt like they did the best they could do in their investigation. However, there is a need for police reform without question. There is tension in the community and fear.
Clark's sisters, Tiffany Roberson and Emma Burns, say the meeting with federal authorities left them feeling sad. Roberson and Burns say they believe the officers should have been prosecuted.
Because they murdered my brother for no reason.
They didn't really murder him. They executed him.
Minneapolis Police Union President Lieutenant Bob Kroll says the investigations into the shooting, both by outside agencies, found the officers' actions were justified. And he says too many people rushed to conclusions about the officers. In a written statement, Police Chief Janae Harto said, quote, I am satisfied with the thoroughness of these investigations, am confident in the results, and I hope the public will accept their conclusions. However, it looks like those conclusions will do little to ease the frustrations expressed by activists who have vowed to keep marching and demonstrating. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News, Brooklyn Center.
The St. Paul City Council is considering a plan to organize trash collection in the city. Under an arrangement in place for decades, 14 different companies compete to provide service. Many residents say this approach results in too many garbage trucks rumbling along streets and alleys. But trash haulers fear losing business under a new system and say they can make improvements without a major intervention by City Hall. Matt Sepik reports.
A non-scientific survey the Public Works Department conducted in March and April resulted in about 2,000 responses on Open St. Paul. That's the most feedback the city website has received for any topic ever. And at a city council meeting last night, the comments kept coming. Steve Yetter lives in the St. Anthony Park neighborhood near the University of Minnesota. He calls the city's method of trash collection disorganized and a failure. Yetter says some people don't want to pay for a hauler and resort to illegal dumping in places such as the Cassota Ponds Wildlife Area.
At this year's cleanup on Saturday, April 16th, volunteers pulled from one pond alone over 40 bags of miscellaneous garbage, 30 car tires, 6 metal box springs, and 5 water softeners. If you went there today and saw the garbage that has been dumped in just the last 6 weeks since the last cleanup, you would never guess that it had recently been cleaned up.
Yetter says uniform trash pickup is a matter of social equity and should be provided to all residents as water and sewer services are. The proposed overhaul is still in its early stages, but it could involve dividing the city into zones or routes and assigning a single collector to each. Steve Ford, a 40-year resident of the Summit University neighborhood, told city council members one truck a week is enough.
Do you know what it's like to have 7 different trash haulers up and down your alley every day? And it gets worse when you retire because you're around all day gardening. And it's not funny.
In the hopes of reducing traffic, Ford says he tried unsuccessfully to get his neighbors to contract with the same hauler. Those who spoke in favor of the existing system say organized trash pickup is a solution in search of a problem, and one resident said he had no trouble getting his neighbors to sign up with a single garbage company. But the people most vocal about keeping the existing system are the trash collectors themselves. Ronna Crewpenny's family has been in the business since 1909, 4 generations.
You're going to take away our livelihood. If this goes through as organized collection, we are out of business. My son, his family, my daughter, her family, and my husband and myself. It will wipe us out. We will not have any livelihood whatsoever. And I think it would be just a horrible situation.
Matt Flugy is the owner of East Metro Environmental, a company that serves about 1,800 customers in St. Paul. Even if organized trash hauling gives each hauler a guaranteed slice of business in the city, he and other operators fear their portions will be too small to provide sustainable income. Flugy hopes to set up a co-op with other independent haulers to establish separate routes based on each company's existing market share. He says that'll reduce truck traffic with minimal involvement from City Hall.
We can work together to come up with a solution that isn't a complete organized collection system, but does address all of the concerns that the citizens of St. Paul have.
Council President Russ Stark says he's open to that.
Really appreciate the independent haulers coming up with the idea of the co-op, at least kind of trying to meet us halfway as a concept. We really appreciate that you're already talking and thinking about some of these options.
The council did not take action on the plan last night, but if the members eventually approve organized trash collection, state law requires the city to give haulers 60 days' notice so they can figure out who will collect trash and where. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And that's your Polycast for this Thursday, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom.